You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
Stephen was taken from us in a horrific act of violence. We cannot even begin to imagine the agony that everyone who loves Stephen is feeling right now.
President Barack Obama leads the chorus of condemnation of the murder of American journalist Stephen Sotloff. Ivor Gaber and Daniela Pelled will join me to discuss that and more of the day's key news stories from around the world. We'll also be checking in with our man in Istanbul and reviewing London's biggest theatrical openings and closings. A little later in the programme, we'll preview the new Horst P. Horst exhibition at the Victoria and Albert.
The studio sets that he was able to conceive and construct at Vogue brought a great amount of his learning in architecture into the Vogue studio.
All coming up right here, right now on Midori House on Monocle 24. A busy 60 minutes ahead, but before all that, Paul Osborne has the latest world news.
The United States will not be intimidated by the murder of a second American journalist, according to President Obama. He says the US will build a coalition to degrade and destroy the Islamic State militant group, which is behind the killing of James Foley and now Stephen Sotloff. Mr. Obama called his killing horrific, and the US Secretary of State John Kerry says those behind the murder will be found.
Barbarity, sadly, is not new to our world. Neither is evil. And those who have murdered James Foley and Stephen Sotloff in Syria need to know that the United States will hold them accountable too, no matter how long it takes.
In the video showing the murder of Mr. Sotloff, there is a threat to kill a British hostage next. But Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron says the country will not give in to terrorists.
A country like ours will not be cowed by these barbaric killers. Yeah. If they think that we will weaken in the face of their threats, they are wrong. It will have the opposite effect. We will be more forthright in the defence of the values, liberty under the rule of law, freedom, democracy, that we hold dear.
On the eve of the NATO summit in Wales, France has announced it's delaying delivery of an assault ship to Russia. Officials in Paris say the conditions are not in place. France had come under pressure to scrap the deal because of Russia's actions in Ukraine. Vladimir Putin earlier said that he expected an end to the fighting in eastern Ukraine to be in place by the end of the week, and Ukraine's president says he's hoping peace efforts will begin in earnest during negotiations in Belarus. President Obama has said if there is to be a ceasefire, Russia must play its part.
If, in fact, Russia is prepared to stop financing, arming, training, in many cases joining with Russian troops, activities in Ukraine, and is serious about a political settlement, that is something that we all hope for.
The army in Pakistan says it's killed more than 900 suspected militants since the start of an offensive in the tribal region of North Waziristan. The area borders Afghanistan and has been a stronghold of the Taliban. But military officials say main towns are now under their control. The offensive in North Waziristan started 3 months ago. The World Health Organization has issued a new call for a coordinated global response to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. Linking it to 1,900 deaths, officials say there is evidence the disease is spreading far faster than the efforts to contain it. In London, a British health worker treated for Ebola with a new experimental drug has left hospital after making a full recovery. William Pooley admitted he had feared he would not survive.
My symptoms never progressed to the worst stages of the disease, the people that I've seen dying horrible deaths, really. I had some unpleasant symptoms, but nothing compared to some of the worst of the disease.
Police in the east of India say they suspect a teenage girl was raped and murdered after protesting against the treatment of her father. The girl's body was found near a railway track in West Bengal the day after she and her father had been ordered to appear before village elders. Her family say she disappeared shortly afterwards. So far, no one has been arrested. The rival candidates to be Afghanistan's president are holding last-ditch talks to try to rescue a deal on a national unity government. Abdullah Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani have both claimed victory in an election 3 months ago, but Mr. Abdullah has questioned the legitimacy of a UN-run recount. His aides have now said they're optimistic a deal can be agreed. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Vanuit Londen. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu é Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette é Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Holanda.
London. London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
And you are listening to Midori House. It's 18.06 here in London, 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio for the next 24 minutes or so, I have Ivor Gaber, recently appointed Sussex University's first Professor of Journalism, and Daniela Pellad, editor at the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. Welcome both. We will start tonight with the murder of Stephen Sotloff. Like his fellow American journalist James Foley, Sotloff was beheaded on camera by jihadists of the Islamic State. And once again, the killing appeared, judging by the accent, to be carried out by someone British, and once again was attended by threats of more where it came from, specifically this time mentioning a British aid worker held hostage by the Islamic State. American, British and other governments have responded with the ritual condemnation. Ivor, I'll ask you first. Obama said, and we'll come to what he said in greater detail shortly, but he said our reach is long and justice will be served. What would that even look like?
I'm reminded of that dreadful saying. He would say that, wouldn't he? because he's in a bit of a bind, to state the obvious. I mean, the emotional response to the dreadful videos we've seen is to say we've got to do something now. And there's a lot of pressure on Congress in that direction, but there's also pressure in Congress saying, he hasn't got the right to declare war. That's our job. He's going too far. He's got the right, as I understand it, to defend the country, and he might interpret it that way. But there's already been more than 100 bombing raids on ISIS, with some degree of success, I suspect, because the very fact that they're reverting to these beheadings suggests that they've got no other, that the raids are hurting ISIS, and this is their response. So on the one hand, you could argue, steady as she goes, these bombing raids to assist the Kurds and the other forces are working. And on the other hand, there's a tremendous head of steam building up in public opinion in the States saying we cannot take this any longer. So all I can say is I wouldn't be in his shoes.
OK, well, this is a longer version of what President Obama had to say.
Overnight, our government determined that tragically, Stephen was taken from us in a horrific act of violence. Like Jim Foley before him, Steve's life stood in sharp contrast to those who murdered him so brutally. They make the absurd claim that they kill in the name of religion, but it was Stephen, his friends say, who deeply loved the Islamic world. His killers try to claim that they defend the oppressed, but it was Stephen who traveled across the Middle East, risking his life to tell the story of Muslim men and women demanding justice and dignity. Whatever these murderers think they'll achieve by killing innocent Americans like Stephen, they have already failed.
Daniela, hard to fault as ever Barack Obama as a public speaker, but how many more times can he give speeches of this sort without the pressure on him to actually do something decisive becoming overwhelming?
Well, the pressure on him to actually do something decisive has never, unfortunately, overwhelmed him to actually do something decisive. Look, I mean, he is in a bind here. What is he going to do? Go back into Iraq? I mean, the Iraqi government is more or less saying, please, America, can you come back and give us a hand? There's nothing very easy that they can do in Syria. But they can carry out a certain number of operations in Iraq, but ISIS headquarters are in Syria. So they're limited in what they can do in terms of, you know, bombing raids, in terms of aiding the Peshmerga. I mean, all of that has an end destination.
The other kind of organisations that get put in a bind by a story like this, although obviously a less drastic one than the bind that governments find themselves in, is media organisations. And there's always been, I think, an uneasy symbiosis, easy for me to say, between terrorist organisations and the news media. But in a case like this, where starkly what Islamic State are doing is murdering people in order to get on the news. And I'll ask you first, Daniela, what responsibility does a media organisation have? Because these murders of James Foley and Stephen Sotloff have not occurred in isolation. 20 years ago, in fact, it's possible that they wouldn't have done them, because 20 years ago, if you beheaded someone and filmed it, nobody would show the footage. But now you're not reliant on media organisations to show the footage. Is there anything media organisations can do or not do to make this sort of thing more or less likely? And is that even our job?
Well, I'm not sure. They do it because it works. I mean, so much has been written and said about ISIS's media strategy and how successful it is. And so it's become something of a cliche. But it's true. They have led the news agenda, all the front pages around the world, full of Mr. Sotloff's murder. I think the response, I mean, there was this idea that we wouldn't, people, you know, campaigns on Twitter, don't watch the video, don't retweet it. I'm not sure how far that had any impact. I think, as ever, with many things on social media, it's about people trying to feel better about themselves.
Indeed.
You have to report it. The stills have been pretty grotesque, even the stills that have been used. But they do it because it works. I mean, it really does.
Elaborating on that theme, Ivor, what does it tell us, though, that ISIS it is known that they have murdered on film at least one Syrian journalist they'd kidnapped, about which almost nobody cared, and that they have dozens more Syrian journalists held hostage, about which there is little in the way of either mainstream media attention or social media hashtags?
I'm glad you point that out, because this year so far has been one of the worst for the killing of journalists in Syria and Iraq, mainly Syria. But they've been very little reported because, as you say, they're the local fixers, the local producers, and they haven't captured the attention. However, I wouldn't stress that this is only a journalistic issue, and journalistic safety is something very close to my heart, because if we are to believe the dreadful black propaganda coming out of ISIS, the next victim could be somebody who's an aid worker, a British aid worker. So I think it just happens to be that the journalists were there and Western and easy pickings, not that they're particularly targeting journalists. I suspect the world reaction would be the same, maybe even more severe for an aid worker, because one thing about these two journalists, two American journalists, as far as we know, they're freelance, I won't say adventurers, but some people would say adventurers. They knew what risks they were going into, and they were going into dangerous places without the backing of a large organisation. The BBC, CNN, whatever, don't send their staffers into those situations. So they would not necessarily attract the same sympathy, if you like, as, God forbid, an aid worker who's gone there to help the people would. So I'm just wondering if it is as well thought out a media strategy. I just think they happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time.
I'm not sure I agree. I think it says something extra, really, about the ISIS feeling of how they control and how they set the media agenda. Because journalists, traditionally, we've been able to say, look, we can tell your story, you know, put forward your side of events, you know, and that has given us a certain immunity. That doesn't happen anymore. ISIS doesn't need a journalist to portray a story or put its case. So I think the fact that they are journalists, I think that was also significant.
It used to be, I know, an axiom that journalists working in the Middle East is that you were, I don't know whether it was actually ever true or just something people used to tell themselves to console themselves, that you were at least safe from the people you were with. That no longer appears to apply. Before we move on to our next subject, though, it does seem worth noting that the state of Saudi Arabia has beheaded at least 23 people in the last month, including a few convicted of sorcery, but they're our friends, apparently. It is now a little over a week since a ceasefire ended the last round of fighting between Israel and Hamas in and around Gaza. Gaza. The foreign minister, unsurprisingly, has come out as among those who says he didn't agree with the ceasefire. What are the parameters of the split?
Well, it's very easy to say that you didn't agree with the ceasefire. And strangely enough, in the Israeli cabinet, Netanyahu and his defence minister, Bogi Yaalon, were on the dovish side because they wanted the fighting to stop.
Dovish being a relative term.
That's
what
I say. Funnily enough, the split is between centrist pragmatists like Tzipi Livni, who say, "Look, we're about to pay a very heavy diplomatic cost because of our actions in Gaza. So the only real strategy available to us is to make overtures towards Abu Mazen. And what would work for us is if he is helped to rebuild Gaza, and." You know, we can leverage that because the siege, you know, has to be eased, and you know the international community has been fairly silent, but you know they are quite annoyed by Israel's actions. The other side are people who are saying no, we cannot give up any security control, not in the West Bank, certainly not in Gaza. And that's being led by the defense minister. There were apparently a shouting match between the two in a cabinet meeting a couple of days ago.
That must have been quite something to hear. You mentioned the West Bank, and you also mentioned the way that international opinion of Israel's actions over the last few weeks has been mixed, to put it charitably. Is this really the moment, do you think, then, to help themselves to another 988 acres of the West Bank?
Well, not to be acting of the Israeli government, heaven forfend, but I think it's also important to put that in context because it's an enormous area of land. But I think it also shows that that Jerusalem is pushing it so far, but not trying to push its international allies too far, because it's part of the West Bank, which is an area C, but under full Israeli control, and under all the peace agreements would be part of a future Israeli state. So as much as a land grab is is appalling, I think it shows that Israel is trying not to push Washington and Europe so far that it comes out in all-round condemnation.
But there is a question of timing. I mean, without going into the strategic position of this piece of land near Bethlehem, and whether you're absolutely right to say it would be part of any international agreement, because certainly definitions of what constitutes Jerusalem would be on the table. However, it's the timing. It seemed deliberate. It didn't have to be done now. It seems deliberately done as part of the split and Andrew referred to, because I think it's the right wing in the cabinet, particularly Lieberman and the defence, saying, you know, we will not put. We're going to show, just because we've agreed a ceasefire, we're not going to weaken in any way. In fact, we're going to strengthen our position. There was, which none of us noticed, a reference by Netanyahu several weeks ago saying it's inconceivable we give up West Bank territories that become another Gaza. And I think it's just very symptomatic of that struggle. You called it a split. A split sort of implies it's 50-50. I fear it is just a couple of dissident voices who are saying to the right-wing cabinet, you know, hold on a bit. I wish I believed that the Israeli cabinet was genuinely split. And I could see Tzipi Livni leaving the cabinet, which wouldn't be great for peace. I have to say, I think every day the prospects, well, at least we've got a ceasefire in Gaza, and I must not underestimate that. That's really important. But the prospects of any sort of longer term peace just seem bleaker than ever.
Daniela, that remark Netanyahu made that Ivor picked up on, the Holy Grail has forever been the two-state solution. That seems markedly less likely now than it did even 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, doesn't it?
I think the two-state solution has receded into the further and further into the past. I mean, people, even on the right of Israeli politics, are saying now, well, maybe we should give the Palestinian citizenship and actually annex the West Bank, and we'll risk having a demographic balance that favours the Palestinian majority in a few years. But the idea of a two-state solution, it seems terribly 1990s now, doesn't it?
It really, really does.
I mean, Robert Fisk, who's not known as an Israeli sympathiser, a very well-informed writer, mainly about Arab politics, has said it's quite impossible. If you look at the distribution of land, the distribution of settlements, a two-state solution is now completely inconceivable. There isn't a cohesive West Bank left to form the bulk
of this. Well, more than that, we're talking about a three-state solution if we include the West Bank and Gaza as two separate entities, which is how they are increasingly viewed by the Israeli political echelon.
We will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, Ivor Gaber and Daniela Pellad. When we return, we will look at Ukraine, where there might be extremely limited grounds for optimism, and ask how Apple can restore faith in its cloud storage.
The entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages and the successes of the business world. Every week we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
It is a beautiful brand that it's all about giving the consumer the best possible product. We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
We put a shingle on the door, so to speak, which said brand strategy company 25 years ago, and people thought we were just mad poets and really didn't get what we were about.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
You get obsessed about the details. And if you're making the same product day in, day out, you build this incredible product that is very difficult to replicate.
So if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
And welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Ivor Gaber, now of the University of Sussex, Daniela Pellad from the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. Russia's President Vladimir Putin claims that agreement to end fighting in Ukraine may be at hand, which is an interesting statement from someone yet to agree that his army is actually fighting in Ukraine. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko at one point spoke of a permanent ceasefire, but later walked that back to the less snappy mutual understanding on the steps that will facilitate the establishment of peace. Further fighting was nevertheless reported in Donetsk, where rebels claimed to be on the verge of taking the airport or retaking the airport and elsewhere. Ivor, I'll ask you first, does Poroshenko really have an option? Because absent outside help, he can't win, can he?
He can't win, but in some sense, is nor can Putin. We're in some sense, a bit of a stalemate. I think Putin's sudden announcement today that a ceasefire is close is indicative that he doesn't have a strategy, that he's all over the place. And I think Poroshenko is having to react to Putin. What they basically want is some sort of messy compromise that they can both walk away and say, we've got what we wanted, a limited degree of autonomy in eastern Ukraine for Putin, and the stability of a coherent Ukraine for Poroshenko. So I think he's very much having to respond to Putin's tune, but equally not wanting to either upset his own population, because there are elections coming in Ukraine, which he's got to start thinking about winning. But he doesn't want to antagonise the Russian bear to the extent that they launch a full-scale invasion. But frankly, he's following a man who I can't see having a grand strategy. For the life of me, I can't see what Putin's trying to do.
Is there not some suggestion, though, and this makes, to the extent that anything he's doing makes sense, this makes a certain amount of sense, establishing a Georgian variety frozen conflict with perhaps Crimea in the role made famous by Abkhazia and the Donbass as the new South Ossetia? Does that sound sensible?
I think Crimea is not even South Ossetia or Abkhazia. I think it's been lost. I mean, that's it, right? Bye-bye, Crimea. But, you know, I think you're right. I think we're looking at the eastern Ukraine, and that might be the best outcome that that Kiev can manage to achieve. I mean, we look at what Obama, I mean, straight back to Obama, what he was saying in Tallinn. He's basically saying, NATO countries, don't worry, we'll look after you. NATO countries, don't worry, we'll look after you.
Georgia, I notice, has expressed enthusiasm for the idea of joining NATO. You can only wish them luck with that.
I think that, but historically, just now switching sides and becoming a great Putin supporter, well, not Putin supporter, but I think what he's trying to do, if he does have any strategy, and I hope I can be of some help to him, it's the old thing of a buffer state. The Russian, going back to Tsarist times, then communist times, and now today, always want a buffer. They want to be surrounded, if not by friends, at least not by hostile states. That's why they're worried about the Baltic. They haven't got the buffer, but they don't want to see Ukraine part of NATO. They've got the Stans, Turkmenistan, etc., as their buffer. And I think that's really, if he has any strategy, it's to try and make sure that Ukraine doesn't become part of the Western alliance.
I don't think there has been. I mean, right from the beginning of this, I haven't been able to determine any cohesive strategy. It's my feeling, for what it's worth, that Putin is feeling his way through this, really, and taking every step as it comes. You know, just judging the reaction from the West and judging the amount of opposition as he goes.
Well, I was trying to be helpful to him and help him articulate his.
But he's not doing too badly from the point listener. Putin's point of view. In terms of achieving, you know, his particular objectives.
Although there's a bit of a paradox tonight, because I understand that the French have finally said, oh, the warships.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, no. Just, you know, a few hours after Putin says we're going for a ceasefire, he must be very confused.
I mean, they haven't said no so much as like, they've sort of shrugged their shoulders.
They have done it. It is a great Gaelic shrug, which I suspect we will be discussing in greater depth later on the Daily tonight. Finally, on this show, though, I think as the previous 20 minutes have demonstrated, we're not currently suffering a shortage of serious news stories. But much of this week's news agenda has been overwhelmed by the theft of private photographs from the cloud storage facilities of several dozen famous people. The fact that most seem to store their stuff on Apple's iCloud has been less than a publicity boon for Apple, especially in the build-up to another of their annoyingly messianic product launches next Tuesday. Daniela, it occurs to me that, well, Apple, first of all, we should say, have said this is nothing to do with iCloud. This was people's individual accounts being hacked by software which eventually guessed their passwords. That may or may not be true. But it occurred to me that Apple are probably going to get away with this because the bizarre reaction, at least it seemed to me a bizarre reaction, of most people was to blame the victims.
Why are these young ladies posting Nicholas pictures of themselves? Why are they taking them in the first place?
I'd quite like to know the answer to that.
Well, the answer to that is that it's none of anybody else's damn business. Yeah. They were for private consumption.
I think that they will weather this storm. I mean, the brand is far beyond that, and beyond any issues of privacy. And I think more than I speak as an old fogey. I don't know if I can speak for you, Ivor, or you, Andrew, but, you know, issues of privacy are seen very, very differently. You know, for any of us to have taken naked photographs of ourselves in our youth would have involved quite a long, complicated process and not some sort of quick selfie.
So many of these things were such a faff.
Yeah, I just gave up. It was just too complicated.
And but more seriously, I mean, if Apple managed to survive various controversies about the labour conditions in the developing world, I mean, I don't think this is going to have very much of an impact.
Although it has impacted on their share price, but I think, as you say, that's a wobble. You know, it's dropped
It was a very small wobble. It was up again another 1% yesterday.
It's down 3% when I last looked later a couple of hours ago.
It's a wobble then.
But it's a wobble. I think there's a bigger issue, and none of us, and I certainly include myself in it, do take our internet security seriously enough. I mean, we cannot remember all our passwords. And I do think that determined hackers, usually with malice aforethought, can get into most of us. I think it's something that we will need to think about. I won't say we're lazy, we're busy people, we want to get on, but it does give pause for thought, and that's no bad thing.
Well, the serious point here is that one of the things that Apple is rumoured to be launching on Tuesday is a mobile payment service called iWallet, which, to the very limited extent that I understand it, sounds ghastly. But of course, people need to be able to absolutely rely on the security of that.
Yes, I mean, I wouldn't. I mean, back to the old foginess, I still keep my money in socks under the bed. I'm not sure that iWallet really fills me with confidence.
Do you really want to share that with our listeners, Daniela, in terms of keeping information private? That's in socks under the bed.
But we do, the only good, well, not say the only good thing, I have to say, I don't worry over much about my using a credit card or bank online, because I have discovered that as soon as there's a glitch, and there have been, and I have been cloned, the banks or the credit card companies race to restitute it, because by internet banking, we're saving them fortunes by not walking into a branch with staff. And so they are desperate to make sure that people think that internet banking is relatively risk-free. So again, socks under the bed are one thing. I feel relatively safe because the banks do give back to you anything that's been malignly taken.
I've only been the victim of credit card fraud once, and it was before the internet. It was a 2-star hotel in Islamabad, which tried to bill me $4,000 for a one-night stay. I could have bought the entire building for less than that. Those were the days. We will have to leave it there, unfortunately. Ivor Gaber and Daniela Peled, thank you both very much for joining us.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Bunches still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll check in with our man in Istanbul and review the week in theatre with Matt Wolfe and hear about a new exhibition at the V&A. But ahead of all of that, Paul Osborne has the headlines.
President Obama has said the United States will build a coalition to degrade and destroy the Islamic State militant group. He was speaking after a video emerged showing the killing of a second American journalist, Stephen Sotloff, just weeks after James Foley was murdered. On the eve of the NATO summit in Wales, France has announced it's delaying delivery of an assault ship to Russia. Officials in Paris say the conditions are not in place. France had come under pressure to scrap the deal because of Russia's actions in Ukraine. The army in Pakistan says it's killed more than 900 suspected militants since the start of an offensive in the tribal region of North Waziristan. The area borders Afghanistan and has been a stronghold of the Taliban, but military officials say that main towns there are now under their control. And the World Health Organization has issued a new call for a coordinated global response to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa, linking it to 1,900 deaths. Officials have said there is evidence the disease is spreading far faster than the efforts to contain it. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Paul, and welcome back to Midori House, live here on Monocle 24. It's 21:32 in Moscow, that's 18:32 in London, 14:32 in Rio. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Turkey, and joining us from there is our Istanbul Bureau Chief, Joseph Dana. Joseph, welcome to the show.
Good evening.
We were talking earlier about the fight against the Islamic State, and we have been talking about that quite a lot. And it is redrawing a lot of maps of the Middle East, both, geographical and political. Turkey, and this is not something you would have thought yourself saying as recently as a few years ago, is thinking about sort of working with the PKK on this one.
Yeah, it's an absolutely kind of bizarre situation that follows this kind of schizophrenic policy that we've seen from Turkey in this increasingly, you know, violent battle with the Islamic State. Today, or actually yesterday, the Deputy Prime Minister made an unusual statement about the situation of Turkish hostages that are held in Mosul by the Islamic State. There's something like 46 different Turkish nationals that are being held there. And he basically said that, you know, the Turkish government is aware of the whereabouts of these hostages and that they're safe. But this is likely preventing Turkey from engaging in any sort of overt military action against IS or even closing some of the border crossings between Turkey and northern Syria. And part of the spillover is actually being played out in Istanbul, reportedly. Reportedly this week, some PKK militants, part of the PKK's youth branch, killed an IS fighter or operative that was in Istanbul. And this is really a dramatic escalation as to what's going on in terms of this fight playing out in Turkish territory itself and, in fact, in Turkey's major city of Istanbul. And so we haven't had an exact confirmation that this actually happened, but it is indicative that there are a number of other actors that are ready to step forward and start kind of fighting the Islamic State inside of Turkish territory. And this is going to be a very, very big problem for the Turkish government and indeed the international community.
After, though, decades and decades of war between Turkey and the PKK, which did leave tens of thousands of people dead, how is Turkish public opinion going to fall on the idea of Turkey now arming the very organization it fought such a long war against?
Well, that's really the million-dollar question, and we've seen a very, very strong push by Erdogan and his new Prime Minister Davutoglu to make this idea palatable. They've been talking about the peace process with the PKK and with the Kurds for a number of months now, and it's really kind of filled a foreign policy vacuum that they've had. Turks are aware that the Turkish foreign policy when it comes to Syria, when it comes to the Islamic State, when it comes to Iraq, is really in tatters. And in that that space where we should be discussing exactly why it is in tatters, we've seen the government push forward this idea that peace is a necessity, that it's going to be coming very soon. And then we've seen this reinforcements from the international community, specifically the Americans, in arming PKK militants. And so I think quite soon we're going to see a very odd alliance formed between some PKK operatives, or at least some of the leadership, and the official Turkish state. And we might see those continued battles unfold inside of Turkish territory, like this reported killing of an IS militant in Istanbul itself.
I want to ask you now about a story more local to where you are. We saw last year an argument over, I guess, the development of Istanbul devolve into riots, which went on for days. The gentrification of Istanbul is possibly proceeding at a slightly more gentle pace, but it's no less controversial.
Indeed, and it's really swallowing up some of Istanbul's legacy establishments. And so there's one breakfast place in the Beşiktaş neighborhood on the European side of Istanbul that specializes in a breakfast delicacy called kaymak, which is essentially clotted cheese with honey, and it's an incredibly important feature of the Turkish breakfast, which in my opinion is the best meal on offer in this country. And one restaurant that's really known really across the whole country is called Pando Kaymak, and it is reportedly going to close its doors after 119 years in operation. And it's really the latest symbol of this gentrification wave, and it's really kind of alivened the culinary community in Istanbul. There's a number of petitions that are going around to try and save this place and to preserve its legacy and its special recipes and whatnot. And it's happening across the city. In fact, tonight on The Entrepreneurs, I interviewed a Turkish man whose family has had a pharmacy and a perfume-making facility on Istiklal Boulevard in the center of downtown Istanbul for really since the Ottoman times, since 1895, and he's had to close his establishment there because of high rents and the gentrification wave. But he's rebranding his perfumes and fragrances and trying to continue this legacy through other means outside of the kind of bricks and mortar establishment. And so this is a problem that's facing all cities around the world, but in Istanbul it has that kind of special flavor because a lot of these, you know, a legacy establishments really date back to the Ottoman time and have seen an incredible slice of world history. And so to lose them is going to be really tragic and kind of like losing a heritage site, as it were.
And finally tonight, Joseph, there are many cities around the world which regard stray animals as a pest and a menace. Istanbul is apparently very much not one of them.
Istanbul is not one of them at all. There's a huge amount of stray dogs and cats on the streets of Istanbul. Anyone that's visited has seen that. But they're very well taken after, you know, looked after. In fact, in the winter, the municipality put the little cat hotel on my block so that they don't have to sleep in the rain and the snow. And one initiative that's catching the attention of the Germans specifically is a recycling scheme in which you recycle your bottles and whatnot, and then that money, those proceeds, go to these feeding centers all over the city that provide free food for the stray cats and dogs. And so it's a very exciting initiative, and it's another, you know, kind of example of the ingenuity, the urban ingenuity that really exists in this city. And it's very, very well looked after and well liked, from what I can tell.
Joseph Dana in Istanbul, thank you very much for joining us. Up next, we will be looking at the new Horst P. Horst exhibition at London's Victoria and Albert Museum. Stay tuned.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock, whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, 1839 in London. Now, photographer Horst P. Horst was one of the leading photographers of the 20th century. Born in Germany, but working mainly in Paris and New York, Horst had a successful 60-year career, mostly at Vogue magazine. The Victoria and Albert Museum in London opens an exhibition dedicated to his life and work this Saturday. On display are more than 250 photographs taken by Horst, including many famous Vogue covers. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco met the curator of the exhibition, Susanna Brown, who began by explaining how influential architecture was to Horst.
I think Horst's background in architecture and three-dimensional design, he studied furniture design in Hamburg, had a huge influence on his work because he came to photography with a great understanding of three-dimensional form and space. And the studio sets that he was able to conceive and construct at Vogue, brought a great amount of his learning in architecture into the Vogue studio. And I think he also drew on classical architecture a great deal. You know, when Horst first moved to Paris at the beginning of the 1930s, he spent a lot of his free time at the Louvre looking at classical art and design. And certainly you see that in terms of the form and the proportion and the lighting in his images. And you know, often he would spend 2 days setting up the lighting for a single photograph.
You mentioned Vogue there. He had a very close association with the magazine. I mean, basically he worked there almost his whole life. How was this relationship between Vogue and Horst?
Horst's career at Vogue spans 6 decades, and he was one of the very few 20th century photographers who comprehensively straddles that world of the pre-war haute couture and the post-war ready-to-wear fashions in America. He's also special in that he's one of the few who is able to make the transition from black and white to colour when new colour technologies such as Ilfachrome and Kodachrome are introduced at the end of the 1930s. Horst very quickly embraced colour and that new language, that whole new way of thinking about image making. And I'm really excited in the V&A exhibition that we've been able to make some fantastic new colour prints from his historic transparencies.
And can we talk about that story about that Vogue helped him flee from Paris actually in the Second World War as well?
For Horst, Vogue really became a surrogate family, I think. You have to remember that in the 1930s there were only 3 editions of the magazine, the American, the French and the British, and Horst's photographs appeared in all 3. His editor, Edna Woolman Chase, was almost a mother figure to him, I think. And you see on his army dog tags when he joined the American army in the 40s that Edna Chase is actually named as his next of kin. So there's certainly a sense of Vogue as being an important family, and that's something I wanted to draw out in the exhibition. There's lots of correspondence in the Vogue archives in New York about, you know, Horst's early years in Paris. What are we going to do about this German in Paris? We need to help him. We have to get him to America. And that American citizenship was quite elusive for Horst for several years. So it was a great moment in 1943 when he finally became an American and changed his surname from the very German sounding Bormann to Horst. And you know, we know him today simply by his one word photographic byline.
Can you see his influence in the work of today's fashion photographers?
I think Horst's influence extends far beyond photography actually. It extends into the world of interior design, into film. You know, Horst was so often called the master of light or the magician of light. And the way in which he lit, particularly those early pictures made in Paris, has had a huge influence. One of the most famous examples of his influence is Madonna's Vogue video, the video for her single, which in a sense is a sequence of recreations of different Horst images from his heyday in Paris in the 1930s. But I think in the way that he has a direct relationship to contemporary photographers, someone who certainly considered him a mentor and a friend is the contemporary photographer Kathleen Naundorf, who interestingly is from the same little town in Germany that Horst comes from, and she shoots predominantly on large format Polaroid film, using a very large and immobile camera, much like Horst himself did. And she's one of a handful of photographers working in that way today.
And among all those beautiful pictures here at the exhibition, what do you think is the most iconic, perhaps? Maybe that's a difficult question.
The word iconic is very overused, but in the context of Horst, I think it is appropriate. He created so many pictures that have become icons of 20th century photography, and perhaps none more so than his Manbochet corset, the corset designed by Ditol for the couturier, Manbochet, or Mainbocker, as the Americans would call him. And that picture for Horst was very poignant. It came to represent really everything that he was leaving behind in Paris when he fled in 1939. And just a few weeks after that photograph was taken, the war broke out, and Horst's career and his whole life was transformed by that transition to America.
That was Fernando Augusto Pacheco speaking to Susanna Brown, curator of the new exhibition at the Victoria and Albert Museum here in London, devoted to the works of the photographer Horst P. Horst. It is time now for some music, and one of the places you probably have seen Horst's images at some point is the video for this song.
What are you looking at?
Vogue by Madonna, featuring the works of Horst P. Horst, which you can see at the V&A from Saturday. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're coming up to the end of the show, which, as regular listeners will be aware, is the time at which we review some or other aspect of the arts. Today, we're turning to the world of theatre. Joining me now once again in the studio is Matt Wolfe, theatre critic with the International New York Times, among others. Matt, first of all, My Night with Reg, it's back. It was very much a creation of its times 20-odd years ago. Does it still work?
I think it works better. I'm at the ripe old age, Andrew, where I can now compare things to their original productions, sorry to say, listeners. And I did see the original production of this 20 years ago at the Royal Court, which was a big success. This one, actually, I think is better. It's interesting. The original production won lots of awards for best comedy. Watching this production, that seems sort of surprising, because although this production is very funny, sometimes very robustly funny, it's also incredibly moving. And I think this production captures more perhaps of the ache underpinning the play. There's also something that's changed, of course, which is that since the original production opened, Kevin Elliott, who wrote the play, has himself died. In fact, he died about 2 months before this production opened. So it sort of has the quality of a requiem as well.
The play is, of course, concerned with AIDS. My Night with Reg. I guess even the idea of the title is a metaphor for the fear that haunted a lot of people in the 80s and 90s about AIDS. Has the play, or at least the way people see the play, developed with our understanding of the disease over the years since it was written?
Well, the interesting thing about it is, in its day, it was described as a gay play, an AIDS play, whatever appellation you want to put at it, and AIDS is never mentioned in the play. And I think now, of course, treatment of AIDS and so on has moved forward exponentially, thank heavens. But it really seems to be now a play about love and loss, which of course transcends disease and sexual orientation. And it's also largely a play about unrequited love. The title is very clever because we never see Reg in the play, although he looms large.
In the same way that the disease is never mentioned, but everybody knows exactly what they're talking about.
Yes. And there's also another kind of wonderful in-joke about the title, in that the characters talk a lot about, you know, oh God, the movies of Eric Rohmer, this French filmmaker where everyone sits around talking and nothing happens. And one of Eric Rohmer's most famous films was called Ma Nuit chez Maud, My Night with Maud. And so there's a slight little reference to that, a play where everyone sits around talking and, in fact, a lot happens.
It's interesting, that development, though, isn't it? Whereas 20-odd years ago, the disease wasn't mentioned because no one needed to mention the disease, whereas now, are you suggesting it's not mentioned because it's actually become incidental to a play which is really about other things.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the specifics of this are a life-threatening illness caused by the issues that generated AIDS, particularly 20 years ago. But it seems to be more general now. I mean, anyone who's had anything to do with love and loss and grief, I think, will be affected by this play. And I think the original descriptions of it helped sort of ghettoized it, and that's not necessary any longer.
Okay, well, let's move along to another production, which does also, as I understand it, touch on illness to an extent. I read your review of it for the Arts Desk,
and
I wasn't sure. The photograph features a jovial young man with tousled hair and an acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
Bad start. Also, there is a reference to it. There's a reference to it, admittedly, as a solo musical, but nonetheless a musical. So persuade me, if you will, to put my pitchfork down.
Think of it... Yeah, put your pitchfork to one side. Think of it perhaps less as a musical in whatever sense you think of that term, probably big, brassy, Andrew Lloyd Webbery. This is none of those things. It's intimate, soulful. It's more like a song cycle. It's actually a little bit like, I mean, I suppose in structure, a little bit like Alice's Restaurant. And what you have on stage are a kind of lineup of guitars, several of which are played by our solo performer, who's also the writer of the piece, Benjamin Scheuer. And they all function in different ways in his life, in his work, in his art. It's the kind of thing that, if the performer weren't appealing, would be ridiculously self-referential and mawkish, because you think, who wants to watch this guy I don't like for 70 minutes talk about his aggrieved relationship with his father, who's no longer living to defend himself, and, you know, his triumph over an illness, which, great, he triumphed over it, but a lot of people get sick and they don't get their own show. But what makes it really work is that this guy is genuinely appealing, and he's not parading self-pity before us. He's actually telling a story that happened to me, meaning Ben Scheuer, and hoping that it is of interest more generally. So from the particular comes the universal.
So how does it actually work? This, we should mention, is taking place at the St. James Theatre Studio, as we probably should have mentioned that My Night with Reg is at the Donmar. But Benjamin Scheuer's The Lion, is it? Does he talk for a bit and then plays guitar for a bit, or is it a seamless flow?
More or less seamless. It's not sort of, and then this happened and then that happened. Now I'm going to pick up a song and tell you about it. It's quite artfully done. There is a director, Sean Daniels. It is actually shaped. And I think what we'll never know is what it was like embryonically before a very smart pair of outside eyes got to work on it. It has about it, you know, just the feeling of kind of a shared reminiscence that if you've undergone anything familiarly, you know, anything having to do with, again, as with My Night with Reg, grief, loss, pain, you'll connect with it. But it's very low key. It's not kind of full of bells and whistles and lots of emotional buttons. It's just a kind of casual musical picaresque. And I think part of its charm lies in that. It should be said about Ben Scheuer, for anyone who's interested, that he's opening for Mary Chapin Carpenter at the end of September in her concert at the Royal Albert Hall. So this is a departure for him. He's essentially a musician, not a theater person. So he's bridging a gap here.
Okay, well, let's move along finally to Dogfight, Matt Ryan's production thereof at the Southwark Playhouse. Dogfight in this particular context, the title is a reference to a somewhat unsavory bonding exercise allegedly undertaken by servicemen.
Yeah, I mean, this really is the kind of musical end that perhaps you wouldn't be rushing to. Although, again, it's minor key, and I don't mean that pejoratively. I mean it in terms of what it sets out to do. It's based, like most musicals these days, on a movie, but instead of being based on Legally Blonde or Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, it's based on a little-known movie from 1991 that starred Lily Taylor and River Phoenix, about basically a bunch of Marines in San Francisco in 1963 who compete with one another to see who can date, or at least take out for the night, the ugliest girl. And that's the dogfight of the title. So, of course, the girl in question, who is courted by the principal character, the main Marine, doesn't realize that's why she's being wooed. She thinks, oh gosh, isn't it nice this guy likes me? So, as with a lot of musicals, there are various life lessons and whatnot to be imparted in the course of a kind of wayward second act. I think the best parts of the show are in the first act. And what's interesting about all of the show is that, given that it's really about men behaving badly, it's the women in the show who are the best. Rebecca Traherne, who's kind of the local tart, and particularly Laura J. Mathewson, who plays the object of potential vilification, who in the course of the show turns the tables, and she teaches our rather roguish hero a thing or two about life, love, and courtship.
Okay, well, that's three fairly full-throated recommendations from you there. Before we wrap up, though, we should look at, I guess, two American classics, which are closing down in London.
Yeah, they're both finishing. One's finishing the 13th, the other the 19th of September. It's really unusual in London to find two kind of A-list productions of A-list American players from the 20th century playing within 30 seconds of each other. But that's what we've had all summer, and we'll have for a few more weeks. One is Richard Armitage of The Hobbit fame in The Crucible at the Old Vic, very long, 3.5 hour, belligerently atmospheric, quite physical production of Arthur Miller's 1953 play about the Salem witch trials. The other is Gillian Anderson and Ben Foster down the road at the Young Vic in A Streetcar Named Desire. Really strange kind of deconstructionist take on the play, revolving set. You often can't see the characters. Sometimes you can't entirely hear them. But what you do get, directed by an Australian, Benedict Andrews, what you do get is a very unusual take on the play where really your sympathies are equally divided between the kind of neurasthenic Blanche DuBois and the brutish supposed villain of the piece, Stanley Kowalski, who in this play really isn't the villain of the piece. They're no villains. They're all just humans.
Matt Wolfe, pleasure as always. Thank you for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And that's all for today's edition. My thanks in particular to our earlier guests, Ivor Gaber and Daniela Peled. Today's show was produced by Thomas Lewis, researched by David Pleasant and Owen Borchers. Our studio manager was Chad Chilvers. The Entrepreneurs is after the headlines at 1900. I'll be back with Emma Nelson for the Daily at 2200. This show returns at the same time tomorrow at 1800. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.